I'm going to turn to the state of Maryland, Baltimore, and we're going to hear about a different approach for analyzing heat islands. The presenter is Kristen Baja. She is the Climate Resilience Officer for the Urban Sustainability Directors Network. In this role, she's responsible for helping cities identify strategic ways to advance climate resilience planning and implementation and build capacity to take action. She directly supports cities by facilitating deeper relationships between local governments and other stakeholders while also advancing learning, collaboration, and momentum around climate resilience and equity. She has a decade of experience, over a decade, in climate resilience and sustainability, and in 2016, Kristen was recognized by the Obama administration as a champion of change for her work on climate and equity. Thanks for joining us, Kristen. We look forward to hearing your presentation.
Well, great. Thanks so much to EPA and to the other presenters. Can you see my screen all right?
Yes.
Okay, great. All right. So I just wanted to give a little background here about the reason that Baltimore got started on this work, the approach that we took, and the reason that this was brought up. And then why we identified the partners that we have for the project and what we've done so far, and then why community engagement and involvement was so important as part of our process. And then we do actually have some next steps and things that we're looking to do moving forward. So just for some background, in Baltimore, similar to Cambridge and some of the stuff you've already heard, we are definitely feeling the impacts from extreme heat. The number of days in which we're seeing 90 degree plus and even 100 degrees are increasing. And we do have data that shows that it's directly, our urban heat island is connected a lot, and urban heat islands, as I was educated earlier in the presentation on, are directly connected to a lot of our impervious surface. Baltimore does have a very high amount of impervious surface and a very low tree canopy, and heat is a major issue for us. In 2012, we had a large derecho windstorm come through during our high heat wave, and people were without power for 7 days, which was just a catastrophic issue for us, and has led to the reason that we've been addressing this work moving forward. The way that we approached it was actually to take the city's all hazard mitigation plan and the risk assessment requirement as part of that plan, and look at how we use our historical impacts and then our anticipated impacts moving forward. And we realized as part of that process, we were able to bring in a lot around our tree canopy and different data that we had around heat, but we didn't have anything down to the neighborhood level. And so a lot of the models that we had identified hot spots, but didn't give us as much as we wanted about priority neighborhoods. One of the things that did come up, though, is that there was a huge temperature difference between where a lot of our readings were coming from by the airport and what was happening in neighborhoods. And so we created this plan called the Disaster Preparedness Plan, and that was adopted in October of 2013. It looked at all of our different hazards, but heat and precipitation really being the two biggest for us, and focusing on all of those hazards, but identifying that we really needed to put most of our action into what are we doing around precipitation variability and what are we doing around high heat. Another big component for us here in Baltimore is for every sort of plan and project, really using equity as a lens for the way that we approach the process. We have a really unfortunate history of redlining and racism that has been part of our policies and practices here. The ordinance of 1910 that led to white blocks and black blocks and our redlining have also really overlapped with where our food deserts are, where our lack of tree canopy is, where our lack of access to green and park spaces are, lower energy efficient buildings, and lack of access to resources. So this is a really important component to a lot of our work and a lot of the way that we approach this. Using equity as a lens to prioritize neighborhoods where we have the highest vulnerability, But also really thinking about making sure that folks within those communities had a role in both informing us of how heat impacts their daily lives and their work lives, but also making sure that they were part of the solution and part of the data and the tracking that we were doing. So really trying to make those strong connections, build relationships, and think about benefits as part of this work. So the city did not, Baltimore, we didn't have any money for this work. We didn't have any grants, and we didn't have any funding set aside for Urban Heat Island work. And so we were really fortunate to have an awesome team of folks at Johns Hopkins University and at the Maryland Institute College of Art, who are a great team of experts who came together to identify how we can do data collection and assessment and how we could do this at a downscaled way. So we put together a strong core project team with them, and these are the folks here at the bottom of the page. I would say Anna Scott is really the main lead for the entire project, but I have to call out also Ben and Meredith and Katie for just being fantastic partners throughout this entire process. They have been really the ones to bring the technology and to think about the data and the way that we can utilize the data, and then they've also had to put up with me, so kudos to them on that. But what came of putting together a project team is actually something we call the Be More Cool project. And for us, the goals were to really understand how heat is a burden in our underserved neighborhoods, to identify ways that heat impacts through awareness and warnings and mitigation, and then also to really generate science-based analysis of heat. So I need I just had to ask somebody here to stop on something, but we used the vulnerability assessment to work with them to determine where we were going to put sensors and how we were going to think about heat island mitigation activities. So we came together and identified the way to use sensors were these little I buttons, and the I buttons, what we needed to do is figure out how to make sure we had these great radiation shields as well, but within a certain budget. So our team developed these low-cost sensors. They have a little button on the inside that also have a radiation shield that was developed directly by the folks at the Maryland Institute College of Art, which was a fantastic experiment and really amazing to watch them do. But then we were able to put these sensors up throughout the community and work with folks on having them hung in their neighborhoods and then have them sort of be part of the process as well. The distribution was prioritized in areas that we had taken from the bigger assessment, from the big sort of heat assessment, and then put into neighborhoods where we knew there was the lowest amount of tree canopy, the highest amount of vulnerability and risk, and also the lower access to resources. And we chose sort of a dense network within East Baltimore in an area where we were already starting to prioritize other initiatives related to health and stormwater and emergency management. So we put up over 150 sensors in those neighborhoods and elevated them on trees and light poles. And this is just an image of some of the data. Thankfully, Anna is on the line, so if you guys have specific questions around the data, I'm not as good with the data as John is from Cambridge. But it shows, you know, a lot of stuff around the question that we had about how much hotter is East Baltimore than at the airport, and how can we capture the neighborhood scale, such as these little intricacies within each of the neighborhoods and inform different initiatives that we wanted to do around health and housing and sustainability for these vulnerable populations. So the biggest things that we've accomplished to date is we have just completed our third year of monitoring outdoor air temperature using those 150 monitors throughout the city. The first year we stayed in a pretty dense area, and the second and third years we expanded it out a little bit more to have the ability to compare, and also it helped us with publishing the research on some nighttime air temperature work, which you can see under Anna Scott's name. We also tried to overlap a lot of what we were doing with the outdoor sensors with some of the work that Meredith McCormick is doing on indoor temperatures and how they impact human health. So that was also published as part of this initiative. And a lot of the work that Meredith's been doing is working with individual residents in the exact same neighborhoods where we prioritized putting the outdoor air quality monitors. So a lot of those scientific findings have been presented at meetings, and then we've tried to share them throughout the Urban Sustainability Directors Network as well. What this has led to beyond just presenting and putting together papers is a lot of the work at the city and some of the initiatives at the city and how we've been able to prioritize those initiatives. So one of our bigger greening initiatives was actually utilizing this data to focus on reusing our vacant lots in the city and identifying ways to reduce stormwater, grow food, and create community spaces that help us revitalize neighborhoods and also think about reducing heat island impact. This has now turned into something called the Green Network Plan, where we're actually modeling closely off of what the Boston metropolitan area has done with its Emerald Necklace, and trying to think about an interconnected series of smaller green spaces, utilizing what has been historically seen as a detriment in Baltimore, the vacant properties, but now we're trying to see them as assets and how we can use them to lower heat island and improve livability. Another big thing that this data has been used for is how we're prioritizing our tree plantings. Like I mentioned, our tree canopy in Baltimore is around 26%, and the goal is about 40% tree canopy cover by 2030. So we've been using this data to identify priority planting locations and also the relationships that were built up with members of the community and different groups to help us with getting them as implementation partners and teaching them through different classes and courses we're providing, such as our Tree Keepers courses and our Weed Warriors courses. Those both focus on climate change and then teaching people how to care for trees, environment, plant trees, and also other maintain their green spaces around their homes. Another big piece that this data has been used for is we started creating a database of different tree plantings that would survive in our hardiness zone shift. So our hardiness zone has already shifted by two just in the past 6 years, and we're anticipating it to shift even more and be more like Atlanta in the next few years. And in that, we are trying to identify which trees we should be planting, where we should be planting them, and the different diversity we should be using. So this data is really helping us as part of our spatial analysis tool, and the data that we're putting into that along with some of the other hazard factors to determine which trees are going to be best and live and the maintenance requirements for those. And like I mentioned, engagement and community involvement has been a huge piece of everything that we do. A lot of the work that was done around this project, we got together with members from the community initially and talked to them about impacts, like I mentioned. We talked to them about the data. We talked to them about the sensors. This is something that both Hopkins did, MICA did, and then our group at the Office of Sustainability did as well. But there's also been opportunities where we can come together and do more training. And this is a picture of Anna actually working with one of the young kids in our community at a large town hall event, showing how the shields were built for the eye buttons and educating about where the sensors have been distributed and how they were built, and really allows all members of the community, but especially kids, to kind of take pride in what they see throughout the neighborhood with these little sensors. So the next steps that we have from here is what's been fantastic is we were able to write a grant along with Hopkins and MICA, our Be More Cool project team, to create something called the Greater Baltimore Open Air Project. And Anna, again, is really leading that work around sensors that monitor both air quality and urban heat. And these are little sturdier than the ones that were created before, but we have over 300 air quality monitors that were assembled along with a local nonprofit here in Baltimore. But we also held several community meetings where folks came out from the neighborhoods and were able to help with putting these boxes together and understanding how they work. We're also trying to do a connection with our most famous station here, the Mr. Trash Wheel with the googly eyes, and potentially put those on these little air quality monitors as well to just show some connectivity with some of the other projects within the city. So this involves more project partners. It brings in the state. I think it scared them a little bit because they were worried we were going to take even better measurements in some locations. But it's been really great because we've been able to bring in community-based organizations and, again, get a lot of that sort of support and implementation and data tracking. It's given, I think, the folks at Hopkins a real good opportunity to explain how data is used to motivate action within government and then also to get some of our other nonprofits involved in this work. And that's really all for us. I will tell you that Anna, thankfully, is on the line. So if you do have any really strong technical questions, she's around to answer them. But that's the reason that Baltimore City really approached us and how we approached it, and I'd be happy to answer any questions around it.
Thanks, Kristen. I commend you on that work. It was very, it's very inspiring to see how you involved the community and you thought of equity. I think other communities are moving in that direction, so your example is a good one for them. So, and I hope you continue to keep up the good work there in Baltimore. We're going to do one more poll question before we go to the general Q&A. This question is, what do you find to be or anticipate being most challenging when you're trying to understand your heat island? Is it obtaining the approval of city leaders? Or is it identifying and designing the best approach? Is it finding resources and funding? Is it finding government, NGO, and other parties? Or is the most challenging aspect finding the right expertise? If you can try to select one, we'll take about a minute or less, and we'll tally the results.
Okay, we have results, and they're not very surprising. Finding funding and resources is the most challenging. That was voted the most challenging, and then followed by identifying and designing the best approach. Yeah, that would be expected. And then after that, we have obtaining the approval of city leaders. Finding the right expertise is next, then obtaining the approval of city leaders, and then finally finding partners.
Thanks, everyone, for participating. I wish I could say that EPA could help with funding, but in our newsletter, we do advertise lots of funding opportunities. The good thing about heat islands is that sometimes grants that are for stormwater management or even smart growth or air quality, there are many opportunities for using grants to apply it to the heat island because of the many co-benefits that come with the mitigation of heat islands, as I mentioned earlier.